products is the two-phase flow pump, which is a vital piece in the oil exploration process. We used to be dependent on foreign supply of this equipment, and due to the sanctions, it was really hard to access it. So we decided to rely on our domestic expertise, and we now build two-phase pumps locally. We also specialize in the production and execution of all kinds of offshore oil rigs from A to Z.
For decades, Iran has relied on drilling bits produced by Germany, the U.S., and even China to pump its crude. But Washington's oil embargoes on Iran made it almost impossible to import efficient bits, among other oil exploration and production equipment. This forced Iran to try its own know-how to build this needed machinery, including drilling bits. And the result is beyond expectation.
Because of the sanctions, the oil industrial companies... could not, you know, import these very important drilling rigs. So in these years, we made more than 300 drilling bits and PDC bits, and we made it, you know, we manufactured it domestically. And we think that we can continue, manufacturing all of the needs of Iran.
In 2018, Iran was the third largest oil producer in the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, following the U.S.'s unilateral withdrawal from the 2015 deal and the reimposition of sanctions the same year. Iran's oil output almost halved to less than 2 million barrels a day, while its exports tumbled to less than 1 million BPDs, down from 2.5 million. This prompted the country to rebuild its oil sector using its domestic know-how, a long-term goal which, if accomplished, will make the country an oil power. Less than a century ago, Iran marked a milestone by nationalizing its petroleum industry. Today, it is on track toward indigenizing the strategic sector. Experts here say this would be another turning point in the oil industry, since it would shield the country's crude from the blows of U.S. sanctions. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Ahvaz.
New communications director Guto Harry walking into the prime minister's office carrying a bag of groceries. Another new face, conservative MP Steve Barclay, now Boris Johnson's chief of staff, part of the prime minister's shakeup at number 10.
It's not actually driven by Boris. It's being driven by a faction that's trying to remove him. And the reason it's happening now is because we're at the mid stage between general elections.
The new appointments come after five of the PM's most trusted Downing Street staff quit last week over Partygate allegations. And more changes are promised as he looks to turn the rising tide of letters of no confidence. Those letters follow allegations of parties held under the Prime Minister's roof during lockdown, when the rest of the people adhered to the strict social distancing guidelines. In total, 16 parties allegedly took place in 2 years of lockdowns. An inquiry conducted by civil servant Sue Gray, although published in its redacted form, only mentioned four of the parties, all of which pointed to a violation of the government's own rules. The other 12 are under investigation by the Metropolitan Police, who stepped in at the 11th hour, asking Sue Gray not to release her inquiry in full, buying the Prime Minister more time. Despite public outcry and the calls from members of his own party on him to resign, Boris Johnson and those closest to him say the country should move on from the scandal.
And this is an attempt actually to remove him, to put a Remainer or a globalist in charge for the next general election. That's what's really going on. I think Boris will stick the course and he'll probably be with us in 2024. And unless Labour finds someone better than Keir Starmer to stand against him in 2024, Boris is much more likely than Labour to win that general election in 2 years' time.
Yet other experts say that while he and his allies work in overdrive to shore up his future as prime minister, the fallout from the Sue Gray inquiry and the ongoing Metropolitan Police investigation hangs over Boris Johnson's head like a Damocles sword. Saipur is up, London.
Advocates and families of Palestinian prisoners have protested at the Red Cross office in the besieged Gaza Strip in solidarity with thousands of Palestinian inmates languishing inside Israeli jails. They protested Israel's inhumane treatment of Palestinian political prisoners. According to the Commission of Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs, hundreds of Palestinian prisoners are suffering from medical negligence.
Israel is practicing systematic medical negligence against Palestinian prisoners. Currently, more than 700 prisoners are suffering from chronic illnesses and are denied proper medical care. Palestinian prisoners also must not be treated inside military hospitals.
Hundreds of Palestinians are also being held in Israeli jails without charge or trial under the so-called administrative detention, where incarceration periods can be renewed indefinitely. During a press conference outside the Red Cross office, the Islamic Jihad movement slammed the inhumane Israeli policy of administrative detention.
As we stand here, we affirm our support for Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, especially those held under administrative detention. They have been refusing to attend courts for 38 days now, because administrative detention is illegal and is a crime against Palestinians.
Palestinian prisoners are denied basic human rights and continue to languish behind bars as Tel Aviv continues to violate international laws and norms regarding the treatment of prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails are prisoners of war, and they must be treated according to international law and norms. Because we are under occupation, Palestinian prisoners need international protection, and Israel must be held accountable for its crimes against the prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners also suffer from prolonged solitary confinement and inhumane detention conditions.
Latest figures by human rights groups show that the Israeli regime has arrested over 1 million Palestinians since 1967, including women and children. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Iran and Kashmir have a long history of cultural, linguistic and ethnic ties dating back to pre-Islamic period. The arrival of great Iranian religious missionaries in Kashmir, particularly in the 14th and 15th century, cemented this bond further. The overwhelming Iranian influence in Kashmir earned the Himalayan region the sobriquet of Iran-e-Saghir, or Little Iran. In February 1979, following the victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Kashmir was among the first to wholeheartedly embrace it. They rejoiced at Iran's liberation from the clutches of the US-backed Pahlavi regime.
I remember when the news of triumph of Islamic Revolution reached here, people of all shades took to the streets in jubilation. Rallies and gatherings were held. Soon after the victory of Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei visited Kashmir, followed by the other prominent revolutionary figures like Mahdavi Ghani and Golzadeh Ghafuri. The bond between Iran and Kashmir has only grown stronger over the years.
People were very minutely and very carefully watching Iran Revolution at that time. And for a few reasons, Kashmir has been, you know, historically connected with Iran and Central Asia. There was a propagation of Islam here and a lot of people converting to the faith of Islam. As a result of Mir Sayyid Ali Hamdani. Hamdani brought economic pursuits like, say, binding industry, paper and binding industry at that time, 550 years back. And along with traditional handicrafts, which were, you know, flourishing at that time in Iran, he brought certain artisans, certain craftsmen, skilled people, and they came along with the propagation of faith.
Political observers and academics in this Muslim-majority region believe the Islamic Revolution's core message of Islamic unity and anti-imperialism struck a chord with people in Kashmir. They derived inspiration from it in their quest for freedom, justice and equality.
People of Kashmir saw it positively. They cooperated with it because there was already a prevailing atmosphere of Muslim unity in Kashmir those days. They joined the gatherings which were celebrated in connection with the celebration of Islamic Revolution and as a message for Islamic unity and the upliftment of the downtrodden peoples of the world.
As the world marks the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, people here in Kashmir take immense pride in being the advocates of this great movement that has championed the cause of Islamic revival and resistance against the arrogant powers of the world. Sayyid Ali Safir, Indian administered Kashmir.
In
Iranians celebrate the 43rd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution that transformed their country from a U.S. ally to a bitter opponent, Yemenis are still facing a deadly U.S.-backed war. This has urged Yemeni politicians to try to learn more about the Islamic Revolution and its stance against U.S. hegemony.
The region was about to fall prey to the American Zionist project, and the Arab regimes would have given up on the Palestinian cause, resulting in the further oppression of the Palestinians and the deterioration of the Arabs' dream of liberation from American hegemony. The Islamic Revolution turned Iran into the first country to be freed from U.S. dependence. It created a psychological balance among the people. As for the Arab puppet regimes, they feared the danger of the people and delayed their normalization with the Zionists. Today, Muslims are aware of U.S. dominating policies and find liberation necessary.
Yemeni politicians and scholars say the Islamic Revolution keeps on inspiring Yemeni people to stand against the U.S. and its supported forces in the region, just as they did on their September 21st revolution 8 years ago.
I still remember the outbreak of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. I was studying in secondary school and Arab people were constantly talking about it. We even wore t-shirts with the image of Imam Khomeini. But given the importance of this revolution, many Arab dictators started to ban the clothes that had the image of Imam Khomeini on them. And this is one of the first memories that I have of the Islamic Revolution. The Yemeni people have learned a lot from the Islamic Revolution in Iran. It encouraged them to stand against the colonial policies in their own country. And this also sparked their revolution of September 21st, 2014.
Since the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Iran has always been a strong supporter of the Palestinian cause and has marked the International Quds Day. And now it is also standing beside the people of Yemen in the U.S.-backed Saudi-led war against them.
Observers say all the free people of the world must look up to the Islamic Revolution of Iran and follow in the footsteps of its leaders in order to stand against the U.S. hegemony. They say the Islamic Revolution will remain a source of pride for all Yemenis. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
While Iran is marking the anniversary of its 1979 revolution, which overthrew a U.S.-backed regime, Palestinians in the occupied West Bank hail it as the most successful revolution in the contemporary era. I met the former speaker of the Palestinian Legislative Council, Dr. Hassan Khreshi. He praised the Iranian revolution as a source of inspiration in the region and beyond. After the 1979 revolution, Iran started supporting the Palestinians. It all began after Iranians took over the Israeli embassy in Tehran and handed it over to the Palestine Liberation Organization. As part of its effort to inspire the oppressed people, Iran aided emerging Palestinian resistance groups, notably the movements of Islamic Jihad and Hamas. Both the Palestinian factions sent their representatives to Tehran, while Iran's support for both groups continue until today. Iran's Islamic Revolution was led by Imam Khomeini. The revolution was driven by anti-imperialist sentiments. To Palestinians, the revolution anniversary is reminiscent of their struggle for independence and resistance against the Israeli atrocities.
Iran's Islamic Revolution is viewed today as a potent, unstoppable force in the region and beyond. An example in this regard is the heroic struggles of the Palestinian people against Israel. Mona Qandil, Occupy Ramallah.
U.S. police violence targeting black people has once again brought Americans to the streets in the northern city of Minneapolis, which is still reeling from the police murder of George Floyd, a black man, in 2020. This time, the victim is Amir Locke, a 22-year-old African-American who was killed when police stormed into his apartment without warning on Wednesday. Hundreds of protesters rallied in the city, calling for the arrest of officers involved in the shooting and an end to discriminatory law enforcement tactics. Similar protests were held in New York City. The officers were carrying out a no-knock search warrant on the apartment. The city's mayor has now announced a suspension of no-knock warrants that have been at the center of heated debates over rising police violence. Back in 2020, the city restricted the use of such unannounced raids as part of a series of reforms that were introduced following mass anti-racism protests.
They barge in before they ever identify themselves, and they give Amir no time to save his own life. And that's something that we don't see white citizens encounter. And the fact that it's happening in Minneapolis again is beyond tragic, it's abhorrent.
Locke's parents say their son was a beloved member of his community and a law-abiding citizen.
I believe that he was executed by the MPD, and I want the police officer that murdered my son to be prosecuted and fired.
Locke's death has reopened the wounds caused by the murder of Floyd and a dozen of other recent victims. Official figures show that black men are three times more likely than white men to be killed by police during their lifetime. But police bullets, batons, or knees are not the only concerns to African Americans. The deep-rooted anti-black racism also shows itself in inadequate access to health care, food, housing, and jobs. In 2020, the injustices long felt by African Americans triggered a nationwide protest movement challenging police brutality and bias in the U.S. criminal justice system. And that movement transformed into a global campaign to fight racism and build a world free of discrimination and supremacist ideologies.
In the limelight.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump could be sensing a revolt from within the Republican Party, having faced criticism from his former running mate and lashed out at senators attempting to reform a key election law. The article you're about to hear has been written by journalist Derek Roche, writing for Newsweek magazine. The piece is titled, Donald Trump Faces Growing GOP Revolt. Former U.S. President Donald Trump could be sensing a revolt from within the Republican Party, having faced criticism from his own former running mate and lashed out at senators attempting to reform a key election law. Republican figures are putting distance between themselves and Donald Trump, one Washington analyst told Newsweek on Tuesday. However, another analyst commented that many are too afraid of their own voters to stage any kind of takedown of Trump from the top. While Donald Trump remains a very powerful figure in the GOP, and opinion polls show he's the favorite to win the 2024 Republican presidential nomination, he has repeatedly clashed with members of his own political party in recent weeks. He is likely to play a major role in 2022 midterm election campaigns, endorsing candidates and appearing on the trail to support them, despite ongoing conflicts with others inside the Republican Party. Former Vice President Mike Pence offered his strongest criticism of Donald Trump yet in a speech to the Federalist Society in Florida on February 4th. Mike Pence rebuked Donald Trump for his repeated claims that, as Vice President, he could have rejected Electoral College votes during the certification process on 6th of January 2021. President Trump is wrong. I had no right to overturn the election, Mike Pence told his audience. Donald Trump responded with a statement slamming Pence, saying, I was right and everyone knows it, on the issue of the vice president's capacity to reject the Electoral College. The former president also used his statement to criticize potential reforms of the 1887 Electoral Count Act and criticized Democrats and rhinos or Republicans in name only, who he said were working feverishly together to change the law. A bipartisan group of around 15 Senate lawmakers, led by Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine, has been discussing changes to the Electoral Count Act with a group of senior Democrats, including Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, who is confident that a deal can be reached. The Electoral Count Act deals with the process of counting Electoral College votes following a presidential election, and Donald Trump has repeatedly railed against any reforms to it. In perhaps another sign that some in the GOP are moving away from Donald Trump, a number of prominent senators have criticized the Republican National Committee for censuring Representative Adam Kinzinger and Representative Liz Cheney, both strong critics of Donald Trump and the only GOP members of the House Select Committee investigating last year's insurrection. All of this comes as Florida Governor Ron DeSantis appears to be a rising star in the Republican Party, with his odds of winning the next presidential election improving considerably over the past year, according to bookmakers. There have also been a number of media reports about a feud between Donald Trump and Ron DeSantis, although both sides have denied there is any animosity between them. Mark Shanahan is an associate professor at the Department of Politics and International Relations at Reading University in the United Kingdom and co-editor of the Trump Presidency, From Campaign Trail to World Stage. He told Newsweek that there seem to be schisms developing in the Republican Party. The GOP seems to be split as the fight goes on for its soul, Shanahan said. Many Republicans were getting set for midterm campaigns or even runs for national office in 2024 by putting distance between themselves and Donald Trump, or at least excluding him from their conversations. But then on Monday, the Republican National Committee, driven by Chairwoman Ronna McDaniel, plunged into the 6th of January insurrection debate once again by censuring Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, he said. What's notable is the pushback that Ronna McDaniel has received from her actions, Mark Shanahan went on to say. Many congressional Republicans don't want Donald Trump to feature in party or policy conversations now. The House investigation is circling. Lawsuits against the former president aren't going away, and his claim of a stolen election isn't getting any more credible. Mark Shanahan said that while Republicans running for Congress still fear Donald Trump's power over the GOP, there are definite signs of a schism, reinforced by recent comments by Mike Pence and Chris Christie. Chris Christie, the former governor of New Jersey and a one-time close ally of Donald Trump, said on Monday that the January 6th Capitol riot was incited by Donald Trump in an effort to intimidate Mike Pence. Every former president's power over their party wanes over time, Mark Shanahan said. Logic suggests that Donald Trump's should too. Of course, he has defied political logic in the past, but the signs are that the political gravity is definitely starting to reel him in. Logic suggests that Donald Trump should too. Of course, he has defied political logic in the past, but the signs are that political gravity is definitely starting to reel him in, while political rivals such as Florida's Ron DeSantis appear to be gaining energy from Trump's continuing struggles, he said. Thomas Gift, a founding director of the University College London's Centre on US Politics, told Newsweek magazine he doubted that the Republican Party was poised to rebel against Donald Trump. From the Russia investigation to the Zelensky call to 6th of January, the notion that the GOP is always just a moment away from a full-out mutiny against Donald Trump is a refrain we've heard over and over again from experts, Gift said. The only problem, it never happens, he said. Trump faced impeachment in 2019 over a call with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, in which he appeared to pressure the foreign leader to investigate Joe Biden, while special counsel Robert Mueller probed alleged links between Trump's 2016 presidential campaign and Russia. Thomas Gift said that the Republican Party of 2022 remains the party of Trump. I'll believe there's a revolt against Donald Trump when there is a revolt against Trump, he said. At the moment, however, GOP voters remain too enamoured with Trump to abandon him. Thomas Gift continued, and Republican politicians remain too afraid of their own voters to stage any kind of takedown of Donald Trump from the top. So to my mind, that this time is different argument is hard to take seriously, Thomas Gift said.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
the span of a very short period of time, the U.S. has sold the UAE and Saudi Arabia hundreds of millions of dollars in military equipment. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why the U.S. sales and even its presence in the war in Yemen has become more prominent.
When Saudi Arabia launched a war on Yemen in March 2015, it assured the U.S. administration of then-President Barack Obama that it would last less than 7 weeks. But the war, aimed at reinstating a friendly regime in Yemen, has dragged on for over 7 years, with limited military gains for the invaders. Yemeni homes, markets, schools, hospitals, weddings and funerals have been struck with U.S.-made weapons. An all-out Saudi blockade has exacerbated Yemen's health and nutrition crises, and disease like cholera began to spread like wildfire. And all those came amid military and diplomatic support provided by the Obama administration. Donald Trump, who hailed from the opposite political camp in Washington, followed in the footsteps of his predecessor in supporting Saudi Arabia and made his first trip as U.S. president to the Arab Kingdom. Hours after landing in the Saudi capital Riyadh on May 20, 2017, Trump sealed a $350 billion arms deal with King Salman, the largest such deal in history. Trump had no compunction about the military support. During a visit by Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman to the U.S., days before the third anniversary of the war on Yemen, he touted finalized and pending sales of military equipment to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. A year later, the U.S. president vetoed a bipartisan resolution to force stop America's involvement in Yemen's bloodshed. In 2021, power changed hands in Washington, but any optimism for a change of policy quickly evaporated.
This war has to end.
That's what incumbent Joe Biden said last year, just weeks into his presidency, announcing an end to U.S. assistance for Saudi Arabia's offensive operations in Yemen, as well as relevant arms sales. However, months later, that promise was broken as his government approved two arms deals worth over $1 billion. To support the United Arab Emirates against Yemen's retaliatory attacks, the U.S. is also deploying a destroyer and fighter jets to the UAE, a key member of the Saudi-led military coalition. In the latest act of military support for the Saudi-led coalition, the U.S. State Department has approved a series of potential arms deals for Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Jordan. Under the deals, both Saudi Arabia and the UAE will receive upgrades to their missile defense systems, and Jordan will get F-16s fighter aircraft. And as long as the U.S. reaps the economic benefits of such deals, the Yemeni people will continue to pay with their lives.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, Emeritus Professor at the University of Wisconsin, Frank Emspach, joins us from Madison. And Yemeni activist and political commentator Hamza Karim joins us from Toronto.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to you both. Hamza Karim, first to you over in Toronto. We're looking at another U.S. military sale that's gone on. This one has been an approval made by the State Department for Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and then Jordan. The Saudi deal is worth about $23.7 million. It includes communication and navigation terminals. The UAE approved to buy $65 million in, spare parts for its missile defense, including Hawk, Patriot, and THAAD systems. and then Jordan, which was a big one. We'll get into that later. Why are these military sales happening in such a short period of time? In this case, the point we're zooming in on the UAE and Saudi Arabia.
Thank you very much. You know, this deal just proves to the U.S. involvement in this war in Yemen. I truly believe that, you know, it happened in a very short time, a short period of time, because, you know, of the recent attacks that the Sana'a government or Ansarullah have been launching towards UAE and Saudi Arabia. However, the fact that, you know, the state, the Defense Department, they've always been mentioning that that Saudi Arabia and the missiles and the defensive missiles that have been selling Saudi Arabia, they were able to intercept 90% of the missiles and the drones sent from Yemen. And now they're trying to upgrade the systems for them and sell them more, which it's really contradicting, right? So you're saying that you're intercepting 90% of the drones and the missiles that have been used to attack Saudi Arabia, and now you're saying that you need to upgrade them because basically they're not doing the right job. That's one thing. And the other thing is that really, at the end of the day, this is, again, this is the U.S. war on Yemen. This war was announced from the U.S. This war has been continuing for 7 years without achieving any goals because of the U.S. support and backing for Saudi Arabia and UAE.
Mm-hmm. The point that you made there, Frank Emspec, and it comes to you, it's a valid one made there by Hamza Karim. He's saying that when it comes to the statement made by Saudi Arabia and its coalition, in a sense, is that they have said that the success rate is actually pretty high in terms of the interception made on these drones. But at the same time, there's these sales that are happening. Is that part of an agreement that the sales continue to happen, to continue this war by the U.S.?
Well, I don't know about agreements, but there was also an arrangement earlier in the week with Qatar, who was not allied so closely with Saudi Arabia, to treat them as a special ally. There is a level of support, it's a gradation of whether you're an ally or whether you have a treaty, and they were upgraded. So what we're seeing here, I think, is a continuation of something that's very, very serious, which is the complete militarization of our policies. And it almost doesn't make much difference which sale is which, because the whole perspective is a military-driven foreign policy. And you see that sort of, that's like the question of the hammer and the nail. To a hammer, the nail is it. You know, there isn't any other solutions. And I think increasingly we're seeing that with American foreign policy. You certainly see that with NATO, where, incidentally, the issues, the arms sales, the treaties outrun the purpose. As they said this morning on a variety of different shows, actually, here in the United States, there were people speaking about the situation in the Ukraine, and they said, well, you know, if there's a war, the Ukrainians are devastated, Europe is devastated, but NATO as a treaty shows that it's really working. Well, the idea of these treaties and whatnot was to accomplish something. And what we're seeing is a totally counterproductive series of things going on, which hurt the people in all the countries tremendously, especially Yemen. And so there is no other solution. If you talk about this, it's driven in large part by issues that have nothing to do with actually bringing any kind of stability to the area. They seem much more driven by the need that some people have to protect, grow, and support the American arms industry.
Well, why is that, Hamza Karim, that there is no political push or drive even mentioned when we take a look at the news on the war in Yemen coming from the U.S. In particular, but we can hear the condemnations that come on the country that's being bombed, and that is Yemen.
Well, yeah, if you're asking, as I mentioned.
No, Hamza Karim, go ahead.
Yeah, so as I mentioned, like for the past 7 years, U.S. and Saudi Arabia could not achieve, you know, any of their objectives militarily. And if there is any political, solution that will be implemented in Yemen, this will show that, you know, the government or Sana'a or Ansarullah side is the winning side, because right now, in ground in Yemen, on ground, Ansarullah or the government of Sana'a they're expanding, and they will not, you know, compromise on any deals. So that will definitely show that Saudi Arabia and U.S. lost this war. That's the first point, I think, which is very important. This matter is very important, especially for Saudi Arabia, because MBS, for him to become the next king, he has to prove himself to be a strong man internally, whether the royal family or inside Saudi Arabia. So for him to lose this war, it's really threatening for him to be, it really threatens him to become the next king. The second point is that U.S. is you know, there is no reason for U.S. to push for a political resolution here. Their arms industry is booming. They're making billions and billions in terms of economic benefits, and they're not held accountable by the international community, because Saudi Arabia and UAE are really in the in the picture of this war. So for them, I don't see why they would really want a political resolution to take place in Yemen.
Well, Frank Imsbach, 1 year anniversary of President Biden declaring that the war needs to end. The offensive support, as he called it, but that the war needs to end was what this 1 year anniversary Friday marked. You had recently Democrats asking Joe Biden that he needs to clarify U.S. role in the Yemen conflict. And offer more than just vague declarations. I'm looking at the $650 million sale to Saudi Arabia, and then you're looking at this particular sale that has just happened. I don't see anything vague about the U.S. stance at this point, which means, as we have said, military sales. Where did Joe Biden sway from that? Because it looked like he was sincere.
Well, I think he swayed from it when they're, according to the newspapers, that the Houthis were able to successfully launch missiles and attack the rear of the Saudis, the United Arab Emirates. There are some American troops there. So that's an excuse to always side with the wrong side, I suppose. And I think that, you know, internally, our meaning the United States sees its interests as the Saudi interests here. And it certainly sees the arms sales that way. So given those circumstances, we would side with the people with the cash. And the people with the cash are the Emirates and the Saudis, certainly not the Houthis, right? And so, you know, there is a pressure to do that. And that's why I mean that the sales and things like that outweigh what would really be serious policy considerations about how to bring stability to the Middle East. Let's be serious here. We've invaded. We invaded Iraq on totally what everybody admits now is it was craziness, right? It just simply didn't happen. There were no weapons of mass destruction, but only because we have a completely militarized policy driven in part by a military-industrial complex. I mean, this is old hat in a certain sense, but you're right. There is not a political force in this country that's capable of taking on that complex.
Okay, this is what where it gets confusing, Hamza Karim. You have the news.
Yeah, there'd be something, but we do not see that.
Okay, I'm sorry. I thought you were done there. I do apologize for that. Hamza Karim, this is where it gets confusing. When you take a look at the news recently, it keeps repeating one particular stance, and that is there's a new front that has now been opened on the war in Yemen. The Yemeni army has attacked the UAE deep in its territory. And it keeps repeating itself, and then you have other news attached to it that have followed, like developments regarding the U.S. being also involved, where it stepped in. It's shot down a couple of these, drones using the missile defense system, as they call it. Why is it that they call that a new front, but they don't come out and call the over 300,000 that perhaps have been killed or more and keep getting killed as that being a new front? Because those civilian casualties are so much more.
Yeah,
who you
again,
at?
This is...
Hamza Karim, go ahead.
Yeah, sure. So, yeah, this is, again, back to the highly depends. These matters really are related to U.S. interests in the region. the U.S. administration, not only this administration, like if you think about it, since the war started in Yemen, there have been three different administrations that came into power in the U.S. It started with the Obama administration, Trump administration, and now Biden's administration. And throughout the three administrations, a lot of foreign policies have changed for the U.S. But one thing that is really in common between these three administrations is the war in Yemen. None of these administrations really wanted to stop this war because eventually U.S. really looks at these wars and assess them based on their interests. Attacking UAE, attacking Saudi Arabia really hurts U.S. interests in the region. But killing civilians in Yemen really doesn't mean anything to U.S. So, yeah, again, U.S. is, okay. is you know, based on this, U.S. Is you know, moving forward.
Sure. That's exactly a good lead into my question, Frank Emspach, to you. The U.S. is moving forward. It's actually becoming more prominent. I mentioned about how it thwarted, as it said, two of the missiles that were shot from the Yemeni army. It is also now becoming more visible by sending fighter jets, warships to the UAE. We understand, obviously, that the U.S. does have a base in the UAE, but you have the guided missile destroyer USS Cole to partner with the UAE Navy. Why is the U.S., or is the U.S. becoming more physically present in this war, and why did it decide to do to take that step?
I think that we're seeing, in part, the results of Afghanistan here, where the United States wants to make it clear that we're not going to be driven out of any place in the Middle East, and that we are still the people to have to go to for arms and equipment, and we're going to do that. I mean, let's be serious here. We are, you know, sort of tied at the hip with the Saudis. Here you have, if we go back three or four administrations to 9/11, right? The people who attacked the United States were all Saudis, and we attacked Afghanistan. You know, so unless we, you know, that was, you would think that we might have some issues with the Saudis or with the murder of that journalist, right? But that's not the case. And so we are wedded to the Saudi regime, which means we're wedded to having MBS become the king and that he be successful. And in order to do that, he's got to win this war, as far as they're concerned. And that's it. And that is that's what's driving this, I think. And the immediacy, in a certain sense, was the precipitous withdrawal in Afghanistan. There was no reason to do that. You could have worked out an arrangement with the Taliban to have an orderly withdrawal. That's what they were trying to do. And bang, you know. And incidentally, by starving them to death, as we're trying to do also, that is a problem for us. It doesn't look good. So we might as well go ahead and do the military option, because that's really where the United States administration, all of them, have been comfortable.
Trying to understand how that is, Hamza Karim, when our guest Frank Emspach says that the U.S. is tied to the hips with the U.S. I mean, walk us through this. You know, you have Saudi Arabia, in which the Crown Prince is, even by CIA standards, responsible for the assassination of Jamal Khashoggi. You have the 9/11 incidents, where you have so many of them who were involved, Saudi citizens. And yet, when it comes to just a thing about oil production, the Saudis won't even help the U.S. out there. How is it that the U.S. is so bound with Saudi Arabia? Why?
I think Trump really answered this question very well when he was a president, and he said that when he was asked in a press conference why U.S. doesn't stop you know, supporting Saudi Arabia, he said, in a very you know, concise and accurate statement, he said, you know, if we stop supporting Saudi Arabia, it means that there will be no Israel anymore. Today, it's very obvious that Saudi Arabia and UAE and Israel, there is an alliance between them. All these countries think that their security, the security of Saudi Arabia and UAE, is really part of the security of Israel. And U.S. will never leave Israel alone, you know, in the region, especially with rising powers in Yemen, in Syria, in Lebanon, in Iraq. this is, I think it's taking more of an, you know, a regional perspective here rather than, you know, a one country problem.
While Hamza Karim was speaking there, Frank Emspach, I was thinking about how the U.S. is involved in this standoff with Russia over Ukraine. You have the situation of the U.S. involved in a crisis in the South China Sea with China. You have the U.S. involved in what we're looking at here in the war in Yemen, not to mention other military engagements. It almost takes the, one's breath away to think about the military engagements. Isn't the U.S. Kind of thin or going thin on all these?
Well, I don't know if it's going thin, but what's happening is that you are having a narrowing of the discussions here. And you also have a very weak government in the sense that you have a good portion of the population for the first time, a third, who's questioning the very legitimacy of the government. And so one response that has been, you know, tried and true for many, many governments in many, many years is a military option where you have a situation where there's crises and you have to rally behind the commander in chief. I don't think that can be completely dismissed here. But in terms of the Saudi issue, I think the United States has seen Saudi Arabia as the bastion of a politics, an anti-people politics, a politics which is extremely conservative, a politics which favors a certain type of capitalism. And that's it. That's the driver in terms of policy. And I don't think you're going to see much change there. To the extent that the Houthis or that people in Iraq or the people in Syria or the whole Arab Spring challenged those policies, those ideas, that organization of society, the United States was going to line up with Saudi Arabia and did and help support, finance and whatnot, all kinds of stuff since the Arab Spring to move the politics back to a more conservative anti-people position, as we did in Egypt.
Final question to you, Hamza Karim. What is your reading into the war games that were held in which Saudi Arabia and Israel were involved with the U.S. and some other, I guess, 9,000 people from 60 regional navies, as it said? What is your reading into having that war game at this point? Especially the fact that you have Saudi Arabia, along with Israel, participate in it with the U.S.
See, the fact that this is happening in the Red Sea really, you know, shows us that Israel is really worried about, you know, having the Red Sea under the control of Ansarullah or the government on Sana'a. You know, controlling the Red Sea means choking Israel because if you control the Red Sea, it means that Israel doesn't have access to water, or you know, most of the ships that are going from Israel and from around the world to Israel could be under danger.
Thank you. I'm sorry to jump in. We're just fresh out of time. Hamza Karim, many thanks. Yemeni activist and political commentator. Frank Emspach from Madison, thank you. Emeritus professor at the University of Wisconsin. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spot.